Welcome to the Humanist Union meeting for June. And our speaker today is Susan Hagstrom, who is going to talk about numbers and superstitions about numbers.
Okay, numbers, superstition versus math. Good versus evil. The human brain has already had fascinating splits in the way it regards numbers. Grasping the unknowable or playing with terminology? Numbers get in our brains, but also our emotions, for good or not. My three examples today are 13 for silliness, 0 for fascinating, and infinity, where the philosophical versus mathematical debate is in many ways still split today. 13, triskaidekaphobia.
What was
fear
that?
Of 13.
Say that again.
Triskaidekaphobia. That's the formal term for the fear of the number 13, created in 1911. And then there's Friday the 13th, Friga Triskaidekaphobia, or Paris Catriophobia. Nice for a number to have your own phobias. There are many reasons given for 13 being a number of ill luck. The more popular are religious, Judas being the 13th guest at the Last Supper, Loki being the 13th god in the Norse pantheon, and the 13-month matriarchal lunar calendar versus the patriarchal solar calendar. Although that could be argued social as well as religious. Legends regarding 13. If 13 people sit down to dinner together, one will die within a year. The Turks so disliked the number 13 that it was practically expunged from their vocabulary. Many cities do not have a 13th street or a 13th avenue. Many buildings don't have a 13th floor. This one I like. If you have 13 letters in your name, you will have the devil's luck. For example, Jack the Ripper, Charles Manson, Jeffrey Dahmer, Theodore Bundy, and Albert DeSalvo all have 13 letters in their names. There are 13 witches in a coven, and the number 13 has been purposely vilified by the founders of patriarchal religions in the early days of Western civilization because it represented femininity. Friday the 13th, it is interesting to note, in Snopes.com, is a largely 20th century invention. The first evidence Snopes found was in 1913 in a book of folklore, and the first newspaper evidence, the New York Times, in 1908. Note, however, 13th being considered unlucky is entirely cultural. Eastern cultures consider, since the pronunciation of four and the word death are only differentiated by an inflection in tone, spelled exactly the same, give four the heebie-jeebie place of fame. Oh. Of course, now the cultural boundaries are crossing so that you have skyscrapers in Asia that go from 12 to 15. And in the Western culture, at least some books now have four as a harbinger of ill luck. But mathematicians prefer to enjoy numbers. 13th, for example, is a happy number with mathematicians. This is basically a sort of game they have. You take each single digit of the number, for example, 1 and 3, you square it. So you go 1 squared plus 3 squared, and then you get 10. And then you go 1 squared plus 0 squared equals 1. And any number that you can do that with that gets down to 1 is a happy number. So you can now say 13th is a happy number. Is 13th is also a very special prime, a Wilson prime. In recreational math, it is only one of three numbers found. The others are 5 and 563. Wilson prime is a number where the prime squared divided by the factorial function of the prime minus 1, and then added by 1, results in an integer. There are only three of those. Computers are now searching for the next Wilson prime. Haven't found it yet. Just these, those three. 513 and 563. So, mathematicians, we like to play with our unlucky numbers. Now on to zero. Books have been written on the history of zero. I have two here, for example. The thing with zero is that it's not really the first step mathematically to think of nothing. The brain sees a number of objects in front of it. It goes, there's the first one, there's the next one, etc., etc. That's what some of the first evidence of counting amounts to. 30,000-year-old marks on a wolf bone, for example. It comes into being more as a need to create a base system of numbers comes about. Some of the first evidence of a zero-like placeholder in numbers, Babylonian mathematics, sort of the present-day Iraq area, Aztec counting systems, those are some of the first. Babylonian math, for example, worked with ones and sixties. So the first, number 10 would be one set of 60 and zero sets of one. Instead of R, where number 10 is one set of 10 and zero sets of one. If that makes any sense. After that, we have the Greeks and then the Romans with their letters for numeral systems. So zero didn't come into the equation anywhere. If you think about the letter system, Roman numerals with their X's, L's, V's, and I's, there is no sort of non-negative zero going on. Indeed, some sources suggest that in their abhorrence of developing the concept of nothing, or the void, as they say, the Greeks would switch to Babylonian calculations, for when they needed their zero, particularly in astronomy, apparently, then restrain their conclusion in Greek-Roman terms. The reasons for that abhorrence are generally considered to be based on their study of geometry. With a background Pythagorean philosophy where understanding nature equated the understanding of mathematics of proportions. The Pythagorean, almost religion held the golden ratio, that where if you divide a line in two, so that the ratio of the small part to the large part is the same as the ratio of the large part to the whole, was in their hearts in almost the same manner as patriots regard the flag and Christians the cross, for example. And not naturally, studying zero or nothing with either geometry or ratio doesn't get anyone very far. Something divided by zero is still basically
zero.
Nothing. The Renaissance and the creation of the Arabic numeral system started mathematicians and philosophers considering the concept of zero along with the concept of a void or a vacuum in manners both useful and silly. Descartes used zero as a starting point for his Cartesian coordinates and developed a methodology still used today for combining algebra and geometry. Pascal, however, used his work on probability theory to do a truly silly proof of the existence of God. All right, there we go. It goes this way. For the sake of argument, imagine for a moment that there's a 50-50 chance that God exists. Pascal assumed that it would be a Christian God, of course. Now, choosing the Christian envelope is equivalent to choosing to be a devout Christian. If you happen to choose this path, there are two possibilities. If you are a faithful Christian and there is no God, you just fade into nothingness when you die. But if there is a God, you go to heaven and live for eternity in bliss, infinity. So the expected value of being a Christian is half chance of fading into nothing, 1/2 times zero equals zero, half chance of going to heaven, 1/2 times infinity equals infinity, so the expectation equals infinity. After all, half of infinity is still infinity. Thus, the value of being a Christian is infinite. Now, what happens if you are an atheist? If you are correct, there is no God, you gain nothing from being right. After all, if there is no God, there is no heaven. But if you are wrong and there is a God, you go to hell for eternity, negative infinity. So the expected value of being an atheist is 1/2 chance of fading into nothing, 1/2 times zero equals zero, 1/2 a chance of going to hell, 1/2 times negative infinity equals negative infinity. So the expectation equals negative infinity. So the wise person, according to this Pascal theorem, would clearly choose Christianity instead of atheism.
Pascal's wager.
It's the same sort of bad logic that you can pretty much declare Winston Churchill a chicken if you want to, using the same sort of logic. So infinity, in many ways, it could be matched with zero, as you just saw, philosophically and religiously and mathematically as well. Religious scholars, in a way, wanted to have things both ways. One of the more well-known proofs of the existence of God by Thomas Aquinas used the concept of infinity. Put simply, there had to be a God since there couldn't be an infinite series of movers and or causes, i.e. God. And the first one is, well, might as well call it God. And then there is, yes, there is an infinite because there is God and he is the infinite. Philosophically, there remains from the time of Aristotle a feeling that one must differentiate, since there would be no actual infinity in nature, between the potential infinity and the actual. Aristotle had a problem in that he apparently felt that there was no example of an infinity in nature, but that when sitting down to do geometry, for example, he came to the conclusion that one can divide a line an infinite amount of time. Just chop it in half, and chop it in half, chop it in half, chop it in half. Note, this potential versus actual is rather similar to the religious arguments mentioned before. My favorite look at infinity comes from the child book, The Phantom Tollbooth. Well, why didn't you say so, said the mathematician, who was busily measuring the edge of a raindrop. What's the greatest number you can think of? 9,999,999,999,999, recited Milo breathlessly. Very good, said the mathematician. Now add one to it. Now add one again. He repeated when Milo had added the previous one. Now add one again. 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 Now add. But when can I stop, pleaded Milo. Never, said the mathematician with a little smile, for the number you want is always at least one more than the number you've got, and it's so large that if you started saying it yesterday, you wouldn't finish tomorrow. I still love that book. But why do I say that infinity and zero are intertwined? Well, first, because they are, in a way, they both cause thought and the rejection of thought. You have the opposite notions going on each time. But also, matched together, they are the birthplace of calculus and modern science. There is a famous paradox created by Zeno. Using the sort of fairy tale concept of tortoise and the hare race, Zeno proposes that the hare can never catch up with the tortoise. Start with the hare running a foot a second, and the tortoise half the speed, and the tortoise having a head start. Zeno argues that for each distance run by the hare, the tortoise would advance just enough so the hare would never catch up. It's a math paradox, of course. In real life, the hare would zoom ahead. Thing is, though, solving such a paradox, working with the notion that infinity will eventually approach zero, and having zero as a concept, well, that's pretty much the birth of calculus, which most people probably studied in high school. Ta-da! So I will end with another math quote from the toll booth. One of the nicest things about mathematics, or anything else you might care to learn, is that many of the things which can never be often are.
Can never be what?
Often are.
Oh. Now, there was another poem that Bob Park got me on. I'll pass it around. I'll read one of the quotes. What's one of the stanzas, because it's a lovely poem on the 13th floor thing, but I'll pass it around if anybody wants to look at it. There's a lovely stanza here. We are higher than 12 and below 14, said Maxie to the bum, and the sickening draught that taints the shaft is the whiff of kingdom come. The sickening draught that taints the shaft blows through the devil's door, and he squashed the latch like a fungus patch and revealed that 13th floor. Ogden Nash.
Oh, I thought it had to be.
I don't know. Yes? Anybody, you want to make comments?
Yes. The heavens are supposed to be infinite.
God is supposed to be infinite.
No, the galaxies are supposed to be infinite. I mean, the universe is supposed to be infinite, you know? That's what I've heard.
It's unmeasurable, but not infinite.
I've heard him say infinite.
But it's not.
How do you measure infinity anyway? You can't get to the end of it to measure it.
The laws of relativity sort of changed that. So now they have two setups where one suggestion is that the solar system and the galaxy is sort of like a rubber band and it's going to go back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. And the other one is that eventually everything will expand to a certain point and pretty much die off. So they are not saying that the galaxy is infinite these days.
And that depends on how much mass there is in it.
Mm-hmm.
Which now they're not being able to find enough mass to have it come back on itself.
By which you mean they have to invent some new math?
No, mass.
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 Mass. As a mass. Material.
Right. Mm-hmm. So now there's dark matter, but I don't know if there's enough dark matter to actually balance.
Through a glass darkly. Susan, I'm reminded of a couple of things as you were talking. One of them is one of the more fascinating books that I've ever written. Write one book, it was called A Master's Thesis, and that was enough.
Okay.
A biography of Paul Erdős, Hungarian mathematician. And since I have a computer along here today, I got a chance to look it up and find a good reference here, an article by Paul Hoffman in the Britannica. And here's his little short thing. Erdős had definite ideas about mathematical elegance. He believed that God, whom he affectionately called the SF, or Supreme Fascist, had a transfinite book. Transfinite being a mathematical concept for something larger than infinity, that contained the shortest, most beautiful proof for every conceivable mathematical problem. The highest compliment he could pay to a colleague's work was to say, "That's straight from the book." I remembered that concept of the transfinite coming from reading about Erdős. A fascinating, fascinating man. The second is within computer programming that I've learned. One of the languages, MUMPS or M, makes a distinct difference between null and nil.
Oh.
Not just zero. But null meaning zero, and nil meaning no data.
Uh-huh. Cool. So really, no information. Means that too, doesn't it?
So some subtleties can exist both for infinity and zero.
So nil is more like nothing.
Nil.
Null is zero, and nil.
No knowledge.
No
information.
No thing.
Yeah,
no, it would be like,
I understand that, but within the language, the distinction was important.
Uh-huh. Well, it's much more acceptable to me to hear somebody say, instead of the universe is infinite, that the universe is unknown. But that's always been true, right? We've never known how big the universe is.
Actually, now I think they have calculated.
Yeah, I think they've just recently agreed that the calculations are correct.
And how big is it?
For this, it's bigger than one. bigger than one.
Sounds like circular thinking to me.
I don't know what their number is.
It's something like 4.5 billion light years.
What was that, Bill?
Something like 4.5 billion light years in radius. Mm-hmm.
That's pretty French to me, and I know French.
Yeah, it's pretty hard to write around.
You can't conceive of things.
Well, light falls, the intensity of light falls at, Bill may know this better, at the square root of the square of the distance. So every time you square the distance, you double the distance, you get half the light. So at some point, the intensity of the light falls to null or nil or zero or what?
We have
double the distance.
When you double the distance, you only get a quarter of the light.
Yeah.
You get double square. Mm-hmm. Which then makes it amazing that they can see stars as far out as they can. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That project where they pointed the camera at this empty part of space and found billions of galaxies.
Yeah.
Not just stars, galaxies. And that was an amazing little piece of
we tend to think what we can't see isn't there.
Right, exactly. And this huge amount of mass was out there floating around.
Given that it's got to be true that there's life somewhere else.
Oh, yeah. I think that's almost without question. I used to think that, you know, or you read where things could be based on other elements to life. But I was just heard somebody talking about how carbon is this amazing element that can do so many things. And that's one of the reasons we're carbon-based creatures. So the chances are probably more likely that other life systems are also carbon-based.
Mm-hmm. Except for who's to say there's not an element we don't know about?
That's well, right. There that's you go, right. That's true. Although there's logic to, you know,
the elements, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So there's logic to predict what elements were not on the chart. Yeah. And they,
when I was a kid, my mother told me there were 98 elements.
And now there's 100 and, what, 20?
Someone said there were 200.
I said there were 92.
The additions are all pretty fat molecules.
Yeah. Yeah, they come and they go.
Oh, by the way, the author of the book is called The Man Who Loved Only Numbers. And it is by Paul Huffman.
Mm-hmm. Can you tell us anything about that one?
Oh, that's what my infinity book is.
Yeah, I was just going to, I didn't figure this out to do it, but there's another proof in the infinity books with Gödel's incompleteness theorem. We're pretty much using a similar logic approach to the is there actually a truth in the world? He basically has a very nice seven-step proof here that the minute you think that you've discovered everything, he can show you a way to show that you haven't discovered everything.
Add one.
Mm-hmm.
Add one.
Yeah, that sort of thing. Yeah. So he says there's no way that there could be an answer to the complete of infinity that way.
I don't think we'll ever know everything either. Well, can we, when things can get smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller and bigger and bigger and bigger?
Right, we were at a lecture when Misha was going to college at University of Chicago. They had like the open parent weekend kind of thing, and they had all these lectures you could go to by the professors, which was fascinating. And one of them was one of the physics professors who did accelerator looking for particles. And he had said, I thought very rashly, that he thought we pretty much discovered everything that was there, which of course immediately within a couple of years was disproved. Yeah. I thought, what an odd statement for a person.
Yeah.
I came out of, I don't know if you went to that lecture too, but I can remember commenting after the lecture, I bet he's proved wrong.
We don't even know what's in the ocean.
That's true.
That's true, we know less about the ocean in some ways than we do about space.
Yeah. Sort of maybe off topic and everything, but when you mentioned religion and everything and numbers, it came to mind, you know, I never thought of and wonder why, is there a book of numbers in the Bible? What's with the title?
Oh, yeah, numbers.
Why? You want the first reason or?
Huh? No, I you know. Just,
I said, yeah, you want the first reason?
Well, that's a good point.
Yeah, I don't know why numbers. I don't remember anything in particular in the book
that had anything to
that
do
applies
with numbers.
To numbers. Mm-hmm. Why the name?
I'll have to go back and look at the
Nobody
book of
knows.
Numbers.
Nobody knows.
Guess we don't have any biblical scholars here.
Yeah.
John,
okay.
John, he knows
more.
It's
not a likely place to find.
Yeah, I'm going to say, I'll Google it.
Of what?
The Book of Numbers in the Bible, what's it got to do with numbers?
That's
what I said, you are the biblical scholar of this group, so you have to live up to your reputation.
But you're not allowed to make it up.
Don't you have a pun?
I think Google is the biblical scholar.
That's what Alice got the computer.
I never thought to question that.
Yeah, that's interesting.
As a good answer.
I can remember going to big hotels in New York when I was a kid, and of course they had 13th floor, and thinking, how stupid.
There's no 13th floor at Capitol Heights.
No?
No.
Interesting.
Superstition was
you can ask the people on the 14th floor who live in a fool's paradise.
That's what I was thinking. What about all those people on the 14th floor who are actually in?
So they're making their procession to the promised land. The people are numbered and preparations are made for resuming the march.
Oh, just like kindergarten.
Okay.
Wear a t-shirt in bright color.
I'm reading Wikipedia
one,
here.
Yeah.
There are many hands make light work harder.
Yeah.
Well, that's it. So
this is when the promise of being like the sands on the beach and the stars in the sky is fulfilled, the numbers increasing.
I'm really more interested in the reasons of finding out that certain numbers have a religious or, you know, life kind of significance. For example, the number 3, which obviously has to do with the Trinity of the religion. But then you get things like the 3 magi. And the groups of 3 seem to be quite pervasive throughout almost everything.
Right.
And
is a big biblical.
Yeah, right. And we can just speculate where this comes from. I mean, the Trinity, of course, is one of the most important phases in religion. And so I'm sure that the importance of this grouping of 3 goes back to that. But are there others? I mean,
well, I wonder if there's something innate, you know, that has to do with numbers and the way we look at things.
Yeah. I don't think anything innate is very hard to find anything innate.
Right.
But most things have some sort of either religious or social significance and background. Seven is an important number. And if you deal with card players or gamers, people who game, they have certain numbers. And the 7 is very important for that. And I'm sure if you dig hard enough, you'd find some sort of a reason for that.
It could be just the favorite number game. I mean, everybody...
Yeah, but why favorite?
Everybody's got, like, a favorite number. I mean, I was refusing for quite a while to choose a favorite number. I thought it was ridiculous. So, eventually, I ended up with 390,625.
Just 'cause.
Yeah.
No, actually, what it goes is the square root of 390,625 is 625. So essentially, the square root is in the number's tail. And the square root of 625 is 25, so the square root is in its tail. And the square root of 25 is 5, so the square root is in its tail. And I just thought that was rather cute.
Well, why don't you give it another square again?
It doesn't work.
That's nothing that's popular or widely known or accepted. That's your interesting kind of thing.
Nah, I'm just saying some people pick favorite numbers for absolutely no reason, whatever, or anything.
But I mean, there are smaller numbers that are accepted by a large group of people. I mean, this is something for mass fans and so forth, and that's fine.
Oh,
but
yes, no, like the absolute.
The 3 and the 7, those are more common. Numbers that are accepted or talked about in literature or in religious writing or by people who have some superstitions. I'd like to get back to your topic of superstitions. I mean, have you looked at some of the superstitions?
Yeah, tell me again about the number 4.
It's a language first.
Yeah, that's the culture for the Asian side. It's getting into our culture. For example, I just found out that one of the latest Artemis Fowl books, if you ever read those, had his character going insane and seeing floating fours all over the place. But it is cultural for the Asian sort of area. And it's a large part of it is because the number four and death are the same spelling, and it's pretty much, you know, how the Asian languages have different words being different inflections. So according to my brother who's been studying Chinese, one of them goes down and one of them goes up. I can't remember which way it
is. So it isn't the written character, it's the pronounced?
Written character is pretty much the same. It's the pronunciation is the two differences. And so both 4 and 14 in that culture are the ones that sort of get, you know,
we have someone on the Humanist Union email list who's currently living in China and who emailed about this number 4. Her son went out and checked the parking lot. There was no space number 4, 14, or 24. They were all skipped. And she mentioned that in Mandarin, the pronunciation of the word number 4 is very similar to the pronunciation of the word die.
So it would be in China that this is true.
And Misha pointed out, I got email from Misha, who said that in Japan, many of the language characters and some of the words were adopted in Japanese from Chinese, and so the superstition got carried over too.
Oh, so the pronunciation in Japanese, that's why I was asking this. So the pronunciation in Japanese is similar to Mandarin, or similar enough.
I'm not positive about that. But
well, speaking as an artist, I like to arrange flowers in threes.
Oh, yeah.
But that's a balancing.
Odd numbers.
Yeah,
three,
just decorating in general.
Yeah,
three,
if you put two things, they split apart and it's just about that.
Sort of like three.
If you put three, that can be more of a homogeneous mix.
Yeah.
Well, on the patch, so is it all, was it printed in the encyclopedia Britannica? And it confirms my hunch about the origin of the Trinity. And that is the Emperor Constantine was sort of flirting with becoming Christian. But he was kind of down on the Christians for having so many arguments about theology and martyrs for heresy. And in 225 AD, when the Council of Nicaea decided to dump the Trinity, there happened to be three major points of view. And under pressure from the emperor, they decided that all three were correct, so they wouldn't have to martyr anybody. And I think that might have happened, and to find it was confirmed in the encyclopedia made me feel kind of clairvoyant.
Back to numbers. The summary here, God orders Moses in the wilderness of Sinai to number those able to bear arms of all the men from 20 years old and upward. So they found 603,550 in that census. Then it goes on to say the tribe of Levi was exempted from military service and therefore not included in the census. And so in this it goes on with subsequent census and other activities. So apparently the numbers definitely refers to the census taking, and if this is correct, that's for determining military strength.
And is that a Roman story?
That's Hebrew.
No, it's Hebrew.
This is
interesting.
Thank you for the answer.
So it's a good thing you asked the question.
Yeah.
It was not for.
Well, you just, I was not
a frivolous.
But it never occurred to me before.
Yeah, well,
non sequitur in the list of names there. Yeah.
And there's an actual explanation?
Yeah.
I mean, I couldn't swear about three. I mean, we do know that the folklore usually has the three sons, et cetera, et cetera. But almost every book you can find out about the history of any number will point out that probably one of the reasons we have a base 10 is what we have.
As opposed to base 7 or base
10. But, I mean, they pointed out that the reason they think the Babylonians went for 60 was because who they were trading with had 60 to begin with.
Well, the community of 60 is has the most.
Factors.
The most factors of small numbers.
There you go.
How did we come up with feet?
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
2, 3, 4, 5.
How did we come up with yards?
With feet, they measured the king's foot.
Is that right?
And that became the standard.
Yeah. Which king the yard is between the thumb and the nose.
That's my understanding.
Measured strength.
Yeah.
Well, the fingers and toes,
yeah, but
we've had base 20.
Oh, yeah. I wondered about that.
But we just didn't.
Yeah, I mean, what culture, what king of what culture do you know?
Oh, British Isle.
Oh, British.
They had big enough feet for 12
It was one where they bound the women's feet.
But I mean, what about the meter? I mean, the foot and the meters are sort of countermanding or competing, and which one was first?
Well, the meter came out of the French Revolution.
Out of the French Revolution. Okay.
So
it's a measure of the distance between the pole and the equator on the radio that goes through Paris.
Oh, really?
Of course.
What was the
length of the meridian between the pole and the equator that goes through Paris?
Uh-huh.
Is 1,000,000 meters.
It's 1,000,000 meters.
So that's,
okay.
Meters.
So that's where they get a meter.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Now they get a piece of metal somewhere.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so the English foot or feet came into being later.
No, it was earlier.
We were revolting against
it. It's a cruder measure.
My foot is long. Everybody should have a foot this long.
Yeah, okay.
It's a fine foot.
It's a long.
Well, that's true. And in the French Revolution, they were going to streamline things more.
Yeah, well, they shortened up a bunch of people.
Yeah. Length ahead.
Well, and getting out of royalty would have been appropriate for the French Revolution.
Yeah.
Get the answer from science instead of royalty.
Yeah, and then of course there was the arm wrestling as to whether the meridian would go through Paris or whether it would go through Greenwich. And Greenwich won for contemporary purposes.
How come you can't go backwards around the world and count it as unwinding somehow? I mean, why didn't the sun come up differently?
I can't read that.
Yeah, well, why can't you keep going and make it last week?
Oh.
Yeah.
That sounds like 6:30. Calvin doing 8:30. I follow Calvin and Hobbes. I read it, and lately. He had to write a story, and 6:30 Talvin got into his time machine box and went to 8:30 to get his homework, but 8:30 hadn't done it either because he thought 6:30 was doing it. So then I went back to 7:30 to fight with him, and meanwhile, Hobbes and 6:30 Hobbes and 8:30 Hobbes wrote the story, and he read it in front of the class without reading it first, and it was all about how he went through all of this stuff to write the story.
Very
Calvin.
Oh,
yes.
Love
it.
Some long poem.
It's no accident that those characters are named.
Bob gave me the hand.
Yes, definitely.
Very sad.
That and the writer had to live with the cat. Sometimes Hobbes is just Sergio all over.
Are there any concluding questions for Susan?
Thank you, Susan. That was good.
Yes.
Well,
I wondered whether you had an interest in numbers from a young age.
Oh, pretty much. I enjoyed the Phantom Toll Booth over the Laura Ingalls Wilder's books, for example.
There you go.
Yeah. Rhyme and Reason sounded a better muses than anything else.
Pretty math-oriented early on, too, right?
Mm-hmm. My bachelor's is in mathematics, so...
Uh-huh. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you,
Bob. Very interesting.